ask your doctor about Air Supra, albuterol budesonide. Eligible patients can pay as little as $0 per inhaler, subject to eligibility rules and maximum savings limits. Restrictions may apply. Visit airsuprasavings.com to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books. I'm really pleased and excited today to welcome a very special distinguished guest, Paul Mendes Flohr. So Paul, first of all, thank you for joining me today on the Think About It podcast.
You're more than welcome.
It's really wonderful to speak to you. You're in Jerusalem, I'm in New York today. And I just want to tell our listeners for a moment. So you are a widely recognized and acclaimed scholar of modern Jewish history and thought. You taught at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and you are the Dorothy Grant McLear Professor of Modern Jewish History at the University of Chicago. And a couple books I thought I should mention to our listeners are an important biography of Martin Buber called A Life of Faith and Dissent. And I'm sure we'll refer to that book. But you've also written books on Gustav Landauer, Anarchist and Jew. So we already hear the theme of a kind of tension in the titles of your books, a kind of interesting kind of tension. You've written a book on German Jews, A Dual Identity, where you look at German Jews as a possible mirror of modernity. It's sharing two different and distinct identities. Then you've edited other books on dialogue as a transdisciplinary concept, another book on Buber, From Mysticism to Dialogue, and you're the editor of Martin Buber's collected works, and you've been the editor of his letters, and he wrote something like 50,000 letters, which are now in the National Archive in Israel. So you've immersed yourself in this tradition, the 20th century tradition of major Jewish thinkers. And I wanted to start out by actually noting something when I started writing to you recently about this small text Buber had on Nietzsche. I kept on saying Professor Mendes Flohr, and I was very formal. And then you said, you could just say Paul. And in some ways I was very touched by that, and it goes to the heart of what I'm interested in speaking to you about, which is Buber's I and Thou. Of what is a genuine conversation, which is what his interest in the 1920s.
Ein und Thou appeared under the title in German, Ich und Du, in December 1922, the date is 1923. He was already close to 48 years old at the time. And to understand the book, contextualize Buber biographically, as also in terms of the German discourse, or the West European discourse, as undoubtedly you're aware of it. Towards the end of the 19th century, a book that was very seminal in this discussion was published under the title Gemeinschaft und Gesellschaft by what we would call today a sociologist, about a term yet had been coined at that time, a man named Ferdinand Tönnies. And it suggested that as we marched into urban civilization, we've lost something very fundamental, and that is the human relationships that were bonded by mutual care and understanding, solidarity, traditional communities, which were small and grounded in some sense of fundamental sense of community. Community in the sense of a shared concerns, shared sense of destiny. Relationships became flawed, flawed in the sense that they were fragmented, guided by an ethos of personal and achievement. One didn't necessarily have a relationship to one's neighbor. And that established a malaise, a sense that something's lost in modernity. And modernity is focused in urban civilization. There was many attempts to recreate within the urban context some sense of community, particularly through nationalism. And that came to a head during the First World War. The Kriegserlebnis, the experience of the war, seemed to be a bonding of that is lost, and perhaps even return with the march into modernity, bourgeois modernity, to be more precise, and overcoming the malaise of the loss of Gemeinschaft, and indeed often referred to the war experience, which was not only the soldiers but the society at large, as they gathered under the banner of German, Polish, and whatever, often on the saying that God is on their side, and God had multiple personalities, because usually contending communities claim that God was on their side. But and Buber himself, like many of his generation, shared in this sense of national identity, both as he was actually an Austrian, but still he was living in Germany, and Austria and Germany were allied, this sense of Kriegserlebnis, a sense of community born by warfare. And also within Zionism, the Jewish community. Again, now we know what we were looking for, some sense of community. And as the war progressed, Buber was brought to, by particularly his friend Gustav Landauer, whom you mentioned before, to realize war is just not a fantasy. It's just not an experience. People die. People are killed, lacerated, orphaned, widowed. And slowly Buber began to reflect on how do we really recreate what was lost in the as we entered the modern world. And I think that's the background of dialogue and the dialogical relationships of which he speaks in I and Thou, my judgment, is a way of restoring the grammar of relationships that have been lost, but not through illusionary notions of community, such as nationalism. And that is a message he also brought to the Jewish community. But I and Thou addresses not just the Jewish community, all of man, all of human beings. In fact, there are only three Jews mentioned in I and Thou, and they're Christians, Jesus, Paul, and Peter, and no rabbi whatsoever. But let me say something about the book I and Thou, how it seeks to recreate some sense of what we might call Gemeinschaft-like relationships. Philosophically, the background is Immanuel Kant. And perhaps you recall, Immanuel Kant said that only type of knowledge that we really can affirm as knowledge is what we gather through our five senses. Going beyond empiricism, but gathering information in your five senses, we have a mental capacity to organize our sense data in a particular way, particularly through categories of time and space and causality. That's what we talk about when we speak of in science. And beyond that, we really, according to Kant, we really can't speak in any authoritative way. So what Buber calls in the I and Thou, we have two ways of entering the world. One way is what he calls I-it. And the I-it is the world that Kant speaks of. And if you read carefully the way he develops that, he speaks about I and it, organizes our world according to time and space. And there's a past and there's a present and there's causality. But then he asks the question, is that really what we expect? What it's really all about in our relationships? And then he introduces the term I, thou. Let me say something about I, thou. It's lost in translation. As you know, as a Germanist, the Germans have two words for personal pronoun, Z, which is very informal, and Du, which is reserved for the relationships between a parent and a child, between the closest of friends, and of course, lovers, if you wish to put them in that category. But give you an example how strict this distinction is. Buber was very close to a philosopher named Franz Rosenzweig. They worked together, collaborated for over 7 years on various projects, including the translation of the Hebrew Bible into German, a new type of translation. They were engaged in a project of renewal of Jewish education and literacy to a community that had lost its roots in Jewish knowledge. They were what we would call the best of friends. I spent some time in Chicago, and of course there you have instantaneous friendships. But they remained for 8 years per Z, this formal. And one day after 8 years, Rosenzweig, in a poem, inadvertently refers to Buber, the more intimate word, Du. And then he apologizes, oh, I didn't mean it. After 8 years of friendship. And Buber said, no, this is crucial. Now we are ready. 8 years that we can really, the Germans even have a verb for it, Dutzen, we can address one of Purdue. And then Rosenzweig replies in a poem, we are now ready indeed, we'll address one another Purdue, but in my heart I will continue to say Z. Now, what I understand by that is, and I'll explain that, is to reach a type of relationship of do, when we address one another in this manner, is to create is to achieve a level of mutual trust. And here I can give you an example of who also a psychiatrist and existentialist, a man named Carl Jaspers, who you perhaps know, he was a psychiatrist, but also a founder of what we call modern existentialism.
Yes, very important in American, because he's the teacher of Hannah Arendt.
That's true, and a friend, not only.
A close friend.
He said, all of us, in order to protect ourselves as we engage in human relationships, are like a snail. We have a casing, a shell that protects us. And it's the way, the titles, the way we dress. I have very French, fancy Belgian glasses. I leave my hair grow long, all unconscious, but it's part of the way. The American sociologist Erving Goffman had a book called The Presentation of Self in the Everyday World. And we all have present ourselves in it, and sometimes we're more guarded than others, other times. And like a snail, will exit the shell when there's no shadow of a threat. And soon there is, the shell or she, returns to what the Germans call a Panzer, which is also named for a tank. Buber talks about his armor. But in the shell, we're not really fully ourselves engaged in the world. And to exit that shell, we need the sense that we're not going to be hurt, that our vulnerabilities, we all have vulnerabilities on one level or another, will be respected. And that's why it's such a long journey to achieve a relationship that Buber speaks of. The relationship, though, for Buber is very crucial terms in German. Beziehung. Beziehung has a dynamic. The German word is ziehen. It's the pull. It's mutual. And so it's not only reaching out to the other in a way of cultivating, nurturing, distrust. And the word trust, I'll come back to, is crucial for the story. But it's also a way of us being able to present ourselves to the other. So it's a mutual sense of being present to one another. And here's it, the German is crucial. The German word for an object, such as this pen that I'm holding, is a Gegenstand, something that's standing over against me. That's the world of it, everything we see. And of course, Buber says, when we relate to other human beings as it, by defining them as German, man, female, elderly, etc., all sorts of categories which we characterize and able to recognize other people, but it can be insidious because it can blunt the reality of that person. You refer to the person as black, and because he or there's a different class, or professor, or not a professor, or it can be very hurtful. Although sometimes we seek to protect ourselves within the eight categories. So the Gegenstand is something that stands over against us. But the word that Buber wants you to talk about is the Gegenwart, which is translated in English as present. Somebody who waits over against you, waiting to be affirmed, waiting to be recognized, not as an it, not simply as a Jew, Muslim, Palestinian, bald-headed, not bald, as perhaps you know, whatever, bespeckled, of a certain age, a certain social status. Because we're not only, obviously, that's often can be very superficial and even hurtful when those terms are laced with prejudice, bigotry. Mm-hmm. Every one of us is waiting to be reached out to, and that's called a presence. And here I think echoes, with, at least in some sense, poetically at least, if not consciously, the verse in Leviticus, you should love your neighbor as you would like your neighbor to love you. Or you should reach out to the stranger because you know what it was to be a stranger. You should love the stranger as you would like the stranger to love you. As already in the biblical commandments in Leviticus, there's a sense of mutuality. We all want to be loved. and here's a great difference between Buber and Levinas, but we'll leave that aside. But let me say one thing else about the translation. In German, one speaks, addresses God. He also, even though God is referred to as the Lord of the universe, the King of the universe, you refer to God per du. God, according to Buber, ontologically, this is philosophical, but also the way we understand experience, the other. God is also what he calls the eternal vow. God is always there as a source of trust. And therefore, when Buber was consulted about the first English translation, was performed Presbyterian Scott, a very gifted man named Reinhard Smith. And they chose the word in translation for do, vow, in order to capture the religious moment. And for Buber, who was in many ways an anarchist and had a very iconoclastic, at least not typical, view of religion, our relationship to God is for our fellow human beings. When we say, address the other human being as a thou, we're also addressing God. And so Buber had many reservations about addressing God through prayer, particularly penitential prayer, a prayer that often obscures our attending a synagogue, a mosque, or a synagogue, obscures the real challenge of serving God in the marketplace. That's a metaphor he takes from a religious community within Judaism called Hasidism. And that's a 17th century popular movement in Eastern Europe, addressing the poor. Judaism puts a great emphasis on study, but if you have to go out and work, you don't have the option to go study, and there are no fellowships available. The vast majority of the poor members of a community cannot devote themselves fully to the sacrament of study. And study in Judaism is understood as a sacrament. Or you can worship God according to the founder of that movement, in the marketplace. And it's not speaking of what's the American supermarkets, best Whole Foods, right? It's not a Whole Foods, but a marketplace or where people struggle over to get the best bananas or the best tomatoes. And how do you worship God in the marketplace? Or when you go into the woods to collect wood? And every aspect of life is a challenge in everyday life. Quotidian life is where we are beckoned to serve God. And that includes our fellow human beings in the most difficult situations, the most ordinary situations. And not just our neighbors in a residential sense, or those who live in a fine, I don't know where you live, but we do tend to live in more or less with people with the same background and interests or economic status. The German word it comes from Luther, actually. Person who's next to you at a given moment, and that person represents all of humanity. So if we reach out to the next person we're by chance meet in a variety of moments of one's life, not necessarily fellow professors or fellow people, bourgeois, etc.
Well, let me ask you a question about what you said about this idea of presence, which I think in American English, we can capture the sense of this, what Buber wants to get to, say, when we know we're in the presence of another person. Sometimes we feel, actually, when someone walks into the room or someone stands behind us, we're aware of that. And he wants to reorient, it seems to me in the book, when he says, we are from the beginning always in relation. There is no such thing as the I, which then exposes itself or goes out into the world and encounters things. And the translation is complicated because I think the thou creates a bit of a distance for an English reader. And then the second word of this book is the human being is in the world. And in English, it becomes man immediately, which in some ways is almost too defined, because I think where Buber wants to go, and I think why this book resonated so much, is that we are already in relation. And he says these word pairs, I, you, or I, thou, and I, it, they are relations. They're not two words put together. They cannot be taken apart.
Right.
So I'm interested in when he comes up with this idea that we are already in relation. There's no prior state where I'm the subject putting myself out into the world, the way you said in Kant, and then we make sense of sensory data, or in Descartes, the philosophical subject, or the liberated European subject after the Enlightenment and all the French and various revolutions, and what he lived through, World War I, the Russian Revolution, this idea of the political subject as autonomous.
Right.
So, so there's this idea of the I-you relation and the I-it relation. And
right.
I think a lot of people read this book for a long time, and I was talking to friends of mine who said, oh, everybody read this book in the 60s. Everybody read this book in the 60s. And there's a second translation by Walter Kaufman in, I think, 72 or something like that. Right. And I think it opened up a possibility, what you said, to reorient ourselves to remember that we are already in relation. It was a kind of, that had been forgotten in this project of modernity where everybody is out for himself or herself.
Right, indeed. On a philosophical level, as Buber's in a school of thought that objects the Cartesian notion of I and the objects that we, that were, I and thou is, of course, as Buber calls it, our dialogue is between two subjects. And that is fundamental to the human experience. He even says somewhere in the book, I'm not trying to give you the page number, but there's an inborn thou. Inborn is that the child is already in relationship in the womb to his or her mother. Of course, the translation of man in German is Mensch. You know, German has Mensch is human being, and there's another word for the gender of man. But he's speaking of the human being, although it's translated in English as man. So intersubjectivity for philosophy is the philosophical grid of Buber's thought, that we live in with one subject, one eye to the other eye, so to speak. And we recognize the other eye as not just an it, but as a fellow subject in the fullest sense. We address that person as a thou, and that's what thou or you. Kaufman had difficulty because he wanted to read Buber's book as humanistic, purely humanistic, and had difficulty with God in the story. So when he comes to eternal value, he uses block letters for the U to give it.
This is actually quite important. So just say something more about that, because I wanted, there's two questions I had, and I tried to read as much as I could about it. And the book has been received a little bit as if Buber is dismissing the I-it experience in favor of the I-you. Although he says in the book, you cannot live without this it, but to live only with it is not being fully human. So we live always constantly in relation to all sorts of things and objects and things we just use, et cetera, et cetera. He said that is not lesser existence. It's just the way we are in the world. And then the second part you just raised, Kaufman wanted this book to be kind of an existentialist book and ultimately downplays the presence of God in that book in a way. And he sort of says, you can use this book and read it as a kind of manual for how to be in the world, and you don't have to deal with God. And I think that is probably misses a fundamental dimension of Buber. Yeah.
Philosophically, Buber wants to ground his notion of dialogue in what we call ontology, mm-hmm. the fullness of being. And God is the ground, the concept of God is the ground of being. He says, if you recall, in the third part of Ionville, you don't have to say you believe in God. There are a lot of people who declare they believe in God and not really related. It's not a question of belief in a sense of confessional statements. It's the way you organize yourself, your engagement in the world, especially others, but also the world of nature, which constitutes for what would Buber call spirituality or religiosity. Philosophically speaking, it is the concept of God as a source of trust, and I'll come back to that in a moment, as the ultimate ground of an authentic life, and allowing us to be authentic to ourselves, like to get out of that shell and to reach out to the other and allow the other to withdraw from that shell. I was just asked to write a little essay on a project on phenomenology of love, organized by two very gifted Romanian scholars. So they asked me, of course, to contribute an essay on Buber's phenomenology of love. And he does speak about love, but love not in the Kierkegaardian sense of preferential love. I'm married almost more than 50 years now to the same woman. And obviously we linked, if you wish. We connected because of some ineffable notion of what we call preferential love, of erotic love, and even not for Buber, it's not even a question of agapeic love, where your sense that you have an obligation to be charitable to the other. It is for Buber a way we encounter the other fellow human beings, and he uses a German word. Well, the English can hear it in English. Love is responsibility for the other, not responsibility in the ethical sense, but responding to the other, the giving a response to the other, German Antwort, to the other and his or her ultimate self, which we now call the thou or the you, if you wish. And that, again, is anchored in the notion of trust. What is crucial here for Buber is that the Hebrew word, a biblical word for belief, is trust. It's translated as in German, Vertrauen, which means trust. God is a source of trust. And here it can be theological for a moment, but it gives a sense of Buber. Remember, Buber doesn't say it's a question of confessional belief. And he actually wrote a book on that, what he calls two types of faith. And two types of faith is belief that if you have metaphysical, theological commitments or convictions, if you wish. That's not what Buber has in mind. And the other form of faith for Buber is trust. And God created the world, and behold, it is good. And in fact, very good. But we experience it as awful, painful, on a personal level and a communal level. Now the world is in the midst of an epidemic. That doesn't suggest that the world is good. And a lot of hateful rhetoric and actions that divide human beings on an intercommunal level, and the personal level, as well as, of course, politically. Mm-hmm. So how can we then bless the world as being good? And it's actually the project of Buber's friend Franz Rosenzweig as well. How do you accept the torments of life? And the ultimate torment of life is that we are finite. We are, and the ultimate signature of our finitude is death. Mm-hmm. Death. That sounds very good. That doesn't sound very promising, especially when people who die in or close to you, whom you love and care for. Well, I need not expound upon that, but. So how do you affirm life with all its fraught realities and still say it's good? And here the notion that God is a source of trust to move on, not to leap out. Just allow me a more, more theological, because it's in the background, but on a philosophical level, or more of a philosophical level of sensibility rather than confessional faith. There was in the early period, more or less the centuries in which Christianity arose, and rabbinic Judaism also developed, a series of movements and sensibilities called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is the Greek word for knowledge. You hear the word agnostic, suggested that the world we live in is with all its foibles. You know, isn't that where our soul was destined to be? We have to just have to escape from this world. And Gnosticism provides arcane secret knowledge how to climb out. And it generally makes a distinction between body and the flesh and the soul. And that had a great appeal. And I just, about 2-3 years ago, maybe more, I wrote an essay on neo-Gnostic attitudes in the Weimar Republic in the wake of the First World War. Renewed interest in Gnosticism on many levels. And that had political implications of questioning any possibility of a humanistic liberal order. It's not going to help. spinning that too far, we have Carl Schmitt and others, you know, political theology, which is really basically a form of Gnosticism. And Buber was interesting. He gathered with several Christians, Catholics Catholics and Protestants, Germany they call it Catholics and Christians, to establish a journal called Le Creatur, to affirm, and Malte Benjamin, others participated, which is the last years of the Weimar Republic, this journal, we have to affirm despite everything that we are creatures and that we have to make, we have to ennoble life somehow. That obviously has a political dimension. For Buber, going back to I and Thou, is we have to, with all the struggles of human relationships, is to ennoble or dignify our relationships for our own sake, not just to be nice and good. And in that sense, Buber's I and Thou is meta-ethical and meta-political.
When you say it in the third part, when you just said, he says, you don't have to believe in God, but you said something right now, but there is a possibility for being in authentic relation or recognizing that we're already in relation to sort of not forget that in a way. So he says you don't need a particular conception of God or an avowal of faith to have this what he considers, I think this book is both normative in a way, this is how you should be, but also just descriptive, because he talks about how young children experience the world, how other cultures experience the world. It reads like a book Freud wrote in the 20s. So if he takes all these experiences of human beings. And so it's normative in the sense, this should be our authentic relationship, but it's also just descriptive, saying this is the relationship you're already in.
Right.
Hilary Putnam wrote this really beautiful little essay on Buber and says, people are embarrassed by this book because no one wants to be told how to be with others. He said, we want description, we don't want normative description. We don't want to be told how to be with others. And he said, it's an embarrassing book for philosophers. The way, which is, I studied with Stanley Cavell and Hilary Putnam says, the way Stanley Cavell's work was embarrassing to most philosophers because there's a kind of normative dimension. But so to go back to when he says you don't have to believe in God, but God is really vital in this book. Without that awareness or trust, we would not know how to be in relations with others.
Right. Two comments. I forgot one, but let me just give one I do remember, and I want to return in a moment. The term Buber uses when he opens the book, there are two forms of attitudes. One is called Haltung, the term they use in German, Haltung, the way you hold yourself, the way you posture yourself in the world, and relating to the world on all its levels, particularly, of course, with our fellow human beings. You could be on God, distant, and you hear that very strongly in a German, Sie, keep your distance, Abstand, you know that. there's a recent book that ten years ago on the social codes of Germany in the wake of the First World, to maintain distance and not express your emotions, because we all terrified, we've gone through a tremendous torment, so we have a social code of not expressing emotions. I recall having a wonderful conversation with a neighbor of Freud's here, of course, now in Hebrewism. She said at one point, what we Germans lacked is Zärtlichkeit, tenderness. I think Americans would say we're uptight. But they didn't have a social code to keep distance. And that Buber is questioning that. Because to keep distance means you're not only keeping distance from the other, but you're holding them back from you. Mm-hmm. And a child, of course, relationships when they are with a parent, so there's a healthy relationship, is tenderness. The tenderness is the moment the child, well, in the womb, if you, we have no way of knowing that, pretty close. But as soon as the child enters the world, he, she is embraced, mm-hmm. that warmth. And that's why the child, the dew is there. It's a haltu.
And I have to ask you, as the biographer of Buber, you have to tell our listeners about, because you do actually refer to this experience he had in early childhood, which structures his life in a way. And maybe you can tell the listeners what his experience was with his own parents and mother, because you bring it up in the biography and you're very cautious. I actually like the way you say, well, it doesn't overdetermine everything he wrote, but it does play a significant role.
Certainly. He was dispositionally not dialogical. He was terrified of other human beings, as many of us are. There's some of us, like you, I guess you're dialogically dispositioned.
Yeah, no, I try. That's interesting. I mean, I listen to his lectures, their lectures on YouTube, which is amazing, this kind of beautiful but halting speech. But you said Buber was not a person who just immersed himself in a sort of social situation.
Yeah, he also had a speech defect as a child due to a birth defect. So he spoke very deliberately. He also was not a native German speaker. And that was the language he forged his intellectual life. I just mentioned to a friend today that in Jerusalem, he was part of the German-speaking community of exiled professors, and one of us, Gershom Scholem, who was a German Jew, in an essay criticizing Buber, opens up with with the line, "Buber was a Polish Jew," and it has no, as a way to say he was really not one of us, and he felt it. And moreover, it's significant. Buber's wife was not Jewish. She was from a Catholic background. And make things worse, if you wish, to put it that way, putting worse in quotation marks, they had the children out of wedlock.
Two children out of wedlock. They ultimately married, but stayed married until I think she passed away in 1950.
They had a very firm relationship.
Almost 60 years or something like that, they stayed together. Yeah. She was a very important collaborator also
throughout. Anything he published, she was a native German speaker, a very gifted writer, he showed her.
Yeah.
And she would correct his his German. Of course, he knew German very well, but there was a concept, and as you perhaps know, what they call minority German. Kafka knew German very well, but he was conscious that he was speaking a language which is not his own. Derrida once said that he only has one language and it's not his own. It's so it's a sense that you're an outsider, of course.
Interesting that you're saying he sort of had this sense of being an outsider. He's in a world which the book you wrote on German Jews, A Dual Identity, where there are an enormous amount of incredibly gifted, important writers, poets, artists, etc., who are both inside German culture and also a little bit outside. Ultimately, I also think the book is really important because you say we have to look at this not just from the catastrophic endpoint of the Holocaust, but also beginning of Mendelssohn talking about enlightenment. Right. Sort of this. But when you say Buber wasn't exactly, it wasn't natural to him to go up to people and say, "I want to open up, I want to," like with Rosenzweig, it takes him 8 years, and even then they're kind of keeping a distance. So why would someone like this, what do you think motivated him to try to propose? And then another book you wrote is A Land of Two Peoples, Buber on Arabs and Jews. So he actually put his philosophy immediately in the context also of politics. He didn't remove himself from the world at all throughout his career.
Not at all, no, definitely. There's a very interesting word in German, which is not fully amenable to translation. It's called Geborgenheit, which means security, warmth. It's related etymologically to the word birth. And I think Buber was searching, understood the urgency of Geborgenheit. He didn't have, his mother left him and his father when he was 3 years old. She dashed off, never said goodbye to him. And that for a child of 3 years, he just couldn't comprehend it. And to the end, the very end of his life, when he's 86 years old, he still referred back to that moment. And it's not just the mother, but the Bogenheit that a wholesome family provides, particularly, of course, with the mother. And then he was sent off. The father couldn't handle him. He's 3 years old. So he went off to his father's parents, who were Orthodox Jews, and they didn't have... They couldn't explain anything to him. They don't know how to deal with it, as is often the case. And they just said, well, you know, pray, observe. And as soon as he left that world, he wrote, I just wrote a little essay on that today, senseless tradition, he called it, at the age of 20, the senseless tradition. It didn't, and it was a tradition that didn't provide him with, as it was experienced, not necessarily the tradition, but his experience as a child who was suddenly thrust into the care of his grandparents, who perhaps didn't know what to do with him, how to handle him, because he was a very unhappy child. You know, he says in his autobiographical fragments, the first experience he had of trust is when he would go to his father's stable. His father had a farm, and he would pet the horse. Mm. Horse, because the horse responded. And that's often why, you know, little pets are important. Booba's household had 9 cats. Cats.
Wow.
Not cats as a delicatessen, but cats. That's sort of a joke, but it didn't work out. But thank you for laughing anyway. But animals, pets are often more reliable than human beings. Yeah, I come home, my wife is has her problems, I have my trust. But when you come home, the cat is always there ready to...
Right. You know, it's nice. Well, when Jacques Derrida taught at NYU, he starts one of his later books on both on hospitality and animals. He says he ate a little cat that moved into his house, and he said, this is a very funny anecdote, and Derrida said, I stepped out of the bathroom and the cat was looking at me and I was embarrassed. Because the cat gave me a sense of another presence. And he said, it's ridiculous. The cat doesn't know whether I'm dressed or not dressed, but he said, my self-consciousness put me in relation to another being. So he opens up reflection, and I always was quite moved, and I thought that was very funny, imagining Derrida coming out of the bathroom with a little tiny, it was a little kitten. But I think what you're saying, what Buber is sort of saying, we have these experiences of Geborgenheit, of feeling held in the world, but also he's in a world where this existential homelessness, as Lukács says, where it's a kind of fragmentation, and there is no tradition that holds him entirely.
Right, indeed. In fact, a book that followed I and Thou, which was the language was expressionistic, and he wanted to, I'll come back to that in a moment, to evoke a sense of experience. Let me go actually say it for now, and then I'll tell you about the other. Towards the end of his life, he was quizzed by various philosophers. How would you, Herr Buber, Herr Professor Buber, characterize your philosophical legacy? And Buber said, I don't really want to... Those categories are not going to really help us. All I wanted to do throughout my writing is to hold your hand, walk to a window, open the window, and point out the window. It's something we all experience, all know. What it means, as you very well put it, to live in a chaotic world, a cosmic world, a world not only is bounded by tradition or small societal relationships. So he's talking about a fundamental human experience of being othered, to use a more common term.
But so what did his legacy was to just basically take his reader metaphorically by the hand and say, I will be with you.
Right. To point out what experience that we all directly acknowledge.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he tried to, the way he wrote I and Thou is to evoke that experience. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, he wrote another book, which is more expository in a more classical sense, which is now translated Between Man and Man in English, but the German term is Schwiesprache, and then eventually came the notion of dialogue, or the term dialogue. And of course, dialogue is not what you mean in literature. It's really this interpersonal engagement, recognition. Again, rooted in and grounded, if you wish, in a particular way we posture ourselves to the world, Haltung. So it's not purely, there's other words in German for attitude. It's not a phenomenological attitude that you would find in, as expressed in Husserl and others. It's not an epistemological or cognitive perspective, but the way you are embodied in the world, so to speak. I was losing track of what I wanted to say. I wanted to say something else about thou. Buber speaks saying thou, but you don't have to say thou necessarily in words. In the book I just referred to, he speaks about just meeting another person eye to eye, or even in the passing in an elevator. Somehow, it's not a long engaged relationship, but simply a moment of mutual recognition. Has nothing to do with words. And a story he tells often, but it's an important story. He was a very famed writer before he, at the age of 48, had this, what he referred to as a volte-face, a turning of his position. 48 is, I'm almost 80, and it's still, but 48 nonetheless is is midway in adulthood. And he already had more than 200 publications by the time he was 48 years old. But in a very different genre than we're familiar with when we speak of Buber as a philosopher of dialogue. And during the First World War, 1916, somebody came tapping at his door at 6 in the morning. And you just don't do that even in the United States, but certainly not with a German professor. Unannounced at 6 in the morning. But fortunately, Buber was already up because he was a vocal heart. He worked very hard. And he saw this bedraggled soldier. And he said, "I've been watching for days from the Austrian front in order to speak to you." Buber was about 6 in the morning, but all right, come in. I can devote to you a half hour, which is very gracious. A man coming to your home at 6 in the morning, uninvited. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can imagine that Buber pulls out his pocket watch, leaves on a table, somehow indicate that the time is essential, half hour. And reflecting on that occasion, he said, "I was very cordial, man, asked questions, and I duly answered the questions as best as I can. And after a half hour, I said, 'I'm sorry, had I had more time, I would have I'm more than glad to continue our conversation.' But we could say respectable, certainly no circumstances, respectable response to his uninvited early morning guest. The following day, Buber learned that this guest, this bedraggled soldier, took his life. And then Buber realized that what he failed was not to address the questions the man articulated, but the questions inscribed in his forehead, in his body language, as I think you would say. And that means learning how to listen. Dialogue is not simply a way of carrying on a conversation, but learning how to listen. Listening appears as the superficial, what Buber would call, to me, superficial. He plays with the German word. Erfahrung was the term that Kant says that the world we gain for our five senses. But for the five senses, we just float over, Erfahrung, which is the German word, over the incidentals, the ordinary sense that are, which we inflect with categories: Jew, young man, uninvited guests, etc. We just follow us, that's the ordinary world. We just glide over it, but it's superficial. And learning how to pierce that matrix of usual recognition. I'll come back to another question you had asked earlier. Is learning how to listen, not to hear. We hear, but not necessarily listen. And that's a great challenge. Regarding the world, the possibility that Buber was romanticizing dialogue, he was challenged by his friend Rosenzweig. But we do live in the world of it. We can't avoid going to the market to buy tomatoes. We can't avoid preparing our lessons or learning how to operate a computer or how to organize lives politically, etc. And so Buber calls it the sublime melancholy of returning to the world of it. We do must return to the world of it after we pierced the armor of the other. Mm-hmm. I give you a very, since I'm an Israeli and I share some of Buba's political, not some, but Buba's political sensibilities. Our life here cannot be at the expense of our neighbors. And unfortunately, well, I don't I can say loud and clear, we're abusing the Palestinians daily. And it's, of course, it's very easy to see them as anti-Semites opposing the usual way we deal with the other, as adversaries. But the adversarial mode retains itself, perpetuates itself, and deepens itself. That's also true, of course, the Palestinians vis-a-vis us. They obviously see us as adversaries. So how do we break that down? I just, well, a few months ago, I received, I can't want to go into names, but a very major political figure in the presidential staff who was engaged in issues of, well, I don't want to disclose who he is because, yeah, but how do we develop dialogue with our adversaries? This is a major figure in America. It's quite, as opposed to negotiating. In other words, how do we pierce the armor of adversarial relations?
Right.
But going back to the Israeli situation, because it's more immediate to my experiences, how do we, under this very difficult situation, develop trust that we learn that is that's Buber's concern, how this can be a land of two peoples, not just one people of abusing the others by, the, well, I don't want to, you know, I'm certain you're familiar with the story. And that's learning to listen, not just to hear of their complaints, and they hear us, and we rehearse each other's political litany. But listening has an effect of, as you know, as a teacher. Your students come to your office hours. Sometimes it's not just their questions about the material covered, but they have existential questions. And it's not necessarily what is verbalized.
When you responded to this kind of immediate political question, what you're saying, this question is not an I-it relation only. This is not just a functional, how do we see their demands and how do we meet our and compromise and negotiate and use all of this. But you're saying something else has to be part of it as well, which is to really see somebody else and to really have what you call in one of your books an unmediated listening without having all these professional, ideological, intellectual, emotional sort of preconceptions. So I think this is why the book was so important in the 60s to people and why people still return to it today. In America, we have the same situation, as you know, that there's this whole idea of a breakdown of dialogue. You cannot talk to the other side. There's no way to speak to these people who hold opposing views. So what's your...
I just wanted to flesh out the idea of a sublime melancholy.
Yeah.
After we've somehow come to a new consciousness, if you want to put it this way, the dialogue that Buber speaks of could take place in a minute. It's transformative in our consciousness, and that has the phenomenological aspects that I don't want to burden the discussion with technical terms, but you do return to the world of it. We live in the world of it. But somehow changing the sensibility of the other, going back to the language of no longer as an adversary, but a challenge to how we can learn to live together and respect one another in terms of our own histories, our own agonies, our own stories. So crucial in the book, I and Thou is the and. It's not I become you, but I remain myself. And in fact, by relating to you, I ennoble myself. I allow myself to emerge from my shell as you emerge from your shell. And that's what trust is mutual.
But this trust, what would you say to somebody to say, well, are you expecting me to trust the other, but I cannot rely on the fact that this person will then also reciprocate. They will just betray me or cheat me or...
Right. So Buber calls that mismeetings, and more often we have mismeetings. You open up to the other and then rebuffed. And the question of course, how you sustain a relationship. Franz Rosenzweig shared many of these concerns with Buber, and he said, marriage is not in the marriage contract. It has to be renewed every day. And we have a Hebrew expression that creation is renewed every day. All relationships are renewed and renegotiated. I'm not the same person. Same experiences, the same torments, the same. I just read this beautiful book, poetry. I told you, I'm renewed every day, and so is my wife. My children.
This is quite a. It's quite radical to think you renew your relationships every day, because that means also you risk the relationship every day, because there has to be then two people involved. So I remember I'd said I studied with Stanley Cavell, who wrote these really amazing books on Hollywood romances, these kind of remarriage comedies, where two people are already married and then they have a possibility to leave the marriage, no children, lots of money, no problems. And he said, this is when it gets interesting, because then you have to make a moral commitment to the other.
Right.
It could not happen. So what you're saying, the renewal every day means also you're risking yourself every day. Because
right, most definitely. Echoing Buber's, so to speak, intellectual curriculum was Nietzsche. He read Nietzsche as a young man, as everyone in his generation. Right. Even as a boy of 16, he sought to translate Nietzsche's Das Spake Zarathustra into Polish, which was the language of his education, not German.
Well, and I'm happy to say, because with your help and facilitation and mediation with the Buber Estate, my little translation of Buber's essay on Nietzsche is going to come out in the New York Review of Books, which is a very young essay when Buber is so excited about Nietzsche, who is a philosopher who says you have to continually risk yourself in this act of creation.
Precisely. That's where so you got the point, yes.
Yeah, but you kind of emphasized that actually in our correspondence about this short essay on Nietzsche, that philosophy is creative, not just critical. It doesn't just diagnose the world, but it recreates it.
Every day is a risk. All relationships are a risk.
Right.
Even this conversation is a risk if I come across clearly, coherently.
I think, Paul, this is actually, I was thinking about this when you were speaking earlier, how do you really listen? And when, before you even brought it up, when my students come to my office hours, I think my obligation is to really see them. And it's not to explain this or that was unclear in class, but if I recognize and see them, it is such an important thing for me to even say, who are my students, and for them to be seen by me. It's certainly not easy.
Not easy, especially if you don't like the student. one of the challenges of being a teacher is occasionally, the students are much more intelligent than you.
Many times, it happens a lot.
So there's a risk.
But actually, I think that's actually nice. You're saying, I mean, also the fact that Buber, what you said, he wrote so much. It is so daunting. I mean, and the collected works. And I think there's also that openness that he continually would revisit things or test them out or write essays or respond to political concerns. He responds to things constantly, it seems. He's not removed from the world in some ivory tower or seminary.
No, certainly. Yeah. I think that was an ethical commitment as well, to be engaged in the world, to listen. And of course, he was very multicultural. He not only was... Because it was part of, so to speak, the matrix, cultural matrix of Austrian-Hungarian Empire, that you knew many languages. Somebody told me a joke. It was in a diary of a father. And some man introduces his son as knowing all these languages in Vienna. And the man says, in response, your son knows all these languages? Does he want to be a waiter? Because he has a new person to speak.
That's fantastic, right?
To be the German word is the Kellner, a waiter in Austria Hungary, you had to know all the languages. But that was Buber too. He entered the cognitive universe of many different cultures and added to them. He knew, for instance, Italian. They loved Italian, and he and his wife spent a year in Florence, and they decided to return. When they returned to Germany, they will be speaking Italian at an evening meal. They hired a maid who spoke from the area of Italy, the purest German, purest Italian, never allowed her to learn German. But she, so the children, all children, they knew it, spoke Italian at home.
But say something about, this is, I think, interesting, about his relation to Hebrew, because I think there was, in your biography, you say there was an uncertainty that he said he never quite mastered Hebrew, and he kept on publishing in German most of his life, right?
Yeah, he knew Hebrew, but spoken modern Hebrew had acquired that. And he was already in his 60s when he came to Palestine to teach at the Hebrew University. And he didn't have experience speaking modern Hebrew. He knew Biblical Hebrew, Rabbinic Hebrew, but to speak. So he had actually a tutor.
Really?
At age 60, to learn how to speak modern Hebrew. Which is, of course, based on the tradition, but it's nonetheless it's a different type of exercise and a different use of vocabulary, etc. So I think the joke was that told Booba, don't worry about speaking Hebrew because you're going to have to speak Hebrew in a more limited way, but then we'll finally have an opportunity to understand what you really want to say as opposed to convoluted German.
Right. But it is remarkable he translates the Hebrew Bible into German, but then he said,
I don't. Oh, he knew Hebrew very well, but not spoken modern Hebrew.
Right. When you think about I and Thou, which, I mean, I understand what Kaufman did because he worked with Buber's son, I think, who was the literary executor of the estate. But I do think the book suffers a little bit from that title alone. And I think because I read it now in English and I read it also in German. And in German, it's a poetic book. It's just sort of, it's kind of, you just read it. It has a lot of ideas. It's not a philosophical treatise that references all these other philosophers. Right. It sort of lives on its own. And when you think about that book today, where would you situate it? I was struck that, to be honest with you, I think it should be up there with Civilization and Its Discontents, with maybe Being and Time, with the major works of European thought, but somehow it's sort of in a strange position.
Right. Buber experimented with, there was a book that preceded that by 10 years, the I and Thou, called Daniel. Likewise, he sought to have, the name Daniel is not referring to the biblical Daniel. It's quite an extraordinary moment. He got an honorary doctorate from the Sorbonne, and they mentioned it in the document, a very elaborate document in French and Latin. He's the author of this Jewish book on Daniel. It has nothing to do with it was a response to Zarathustra. Daniel was also a denizen of the Iranian world. It's very clear that he's what we call Zarathustra-Stil in German, the style of Zarathustra. Which is on the border of what we call expressionism, evoking human experiences, etc., if you're familiar with that. And he tried to do that in I and Thou as a poetic philosophy in order to evoke a sense of what we all know or should know. Behind it is a philosophical issue that I believe is also there. Otto Schopenhauer, because a contemporary of, preceded Nietzsche, contemporary of Hegel, I should say, a man had a lot of sense of despair. He would schedule his classes the same time that Hegel had his, and Hegel was very famous, and he was one. Hegel has 300 students, I have two. And he continued to do that. But behind it was a sense of human loneliness, and he contributes it to the Kantian world. I'm certain you're familiar with this. Is that Kant told us the world is organized, taught us that they acknowledge that the world is organized according to sense data, which then we organize through our mental activities, time and space, which allows us to say, when the space, this pen is not this, I am not you, according to Schopenhauer. The distance is one of isolation, and therefore he recommends that we, as you perhaps call, turn to the Indian wisdom of Nirvana, to break off our relationships to this world. But towards the through Nietzsche, there was a revival of our interest in the Schopenhauer. You know, I'm certain, you know, it had registered in music and in art in the end of the 19th and early, the turn into the 20th century. There was a revival interest in Schopenhauer, again, evoking this notion that the modern world, we're isolated from one another. How do we overcome? Buber's friend Randall, you mentioned before, was a part of that discourse, and he said in German, said powerful German, "Hätte ich keine Augen, had I no eyes, I would not be able to be separated from you. I would not be torn into the web of isolation, the world of Buber would call I it, or Kant calls the world of a firewall, and the world that appears to us we're isolated." Necessarily, I'm not you, and you're not me, but we're isolated, and that's part of the story as well. How do we overcome? And that's what infuses Buber's understanding of the I-it world. If you read, well, if it was a class, I would show you how he's saying that when he talks about this, about the I-it world, isolated.
He's necessary but isolated, right? I think. What I took from reading the book recently, it's very hopeful and kind of daring in a way to say, no, we have this capacity. We have this capacity to actually have, to be in real relation. We probably retreat from it quite a lot because it's easier, it's safer, as you said, we retreat into our shell.
And it hurts often. That's a term he coins, mismeaning, vergebung. Mm-hmm. And that's what he learned about from his mother. He reached out to her. Mm-hmm. And little boy, Ma, where are you going? Never turned around to say goodbye. Many years later, when he introduced her to his children, he couldn't look at her in the eyes. He couldn't. Mm. He felt betrayed.
But it's
and just, that concept of mismeeting, and it, we often have rebuffed and hurt. But without that risk, you very well put it in, there's a risk in relationships. You go out of your shell and then, reach out.
Paul, I want to say, I wrote you this email, we were sort of connected through our friend Amir at Stanford, who I'm really close to, and then my advisor, Jeffrey Hartman, and René, they invited you to Yale a long time to give the talks that became that book, German Jews, A Dual Identity. So I actually, for me, it's really moving and wonderful to be on Zoom with you. It's really a nice experience. And then I just want to also share this with our listeners. I think I read as much as I could. I read, of course, Martin Buber, Life of Faith and Descent, your biography. I read German Jews, A Dual Identity, which is a short book for our readers. So people can read that actually pretty quickly, right? And then you've also edited Dialogue as a Transdisciplinary Concept, How This Could Be Used. So I just want to thank you for opening up an intellectual space that somehow I wasn't quite tuned into as much. I mean, I also listened to a lecture you gave on Heidegger and Buber, which we could have an entire other conversation on, which is just fascinating how Buber managed to respond to Heidegger, who kind of didn't listen to him in a certain way. But I just want to thank you for this this opening up this man's work to the world today. It's so critical, I think. And I think I and Thou should be retranslated, with all due respect to Walter Kaufman and the Scott.
I want to thank you. I very much enjoyed meeting you and meeting you in a dialogical sense.
In a dialogical sense, exactly. So I hope we can continue this conversation. Buber probably would have said a real live meeting is also important, right?
Indeed. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much. So again, I want to thank Professor Paul Mendes-Flohr. So Paul, it's been a real pleasure and a joy. And I will let you know when we post this episode, which I think will attract a lot of attention in a time when dialogue is urgently needed.